All right. So why don't we get started again? Looking at our agenda for the rest of today, we're going to have a session on common exam findings and how to prepare for an NFA exam. Then we'll move on to cybersecurity update and finish up with record keeping any communications. Before we get started, I did want to make an announcement. All of the slides that we are using today are already on the NFA website, because I did see a lot of you taking pictures and stuff like that. That's under resources when you press on your member category, so you can definitely check those out if you were taking notes and stuff like that. So with that, I'm going to pass it along to Patty, Don, and Steve Coleman from the Futures Compliance Department here at NFA. Thank you.
Thanks, Matthew. Hi, everyone. I'm Patty Cushing. I'm a director of examinations at NFA. And with me today is Don Grossmith and Steve Coleman, both who are managers in exams. And they can, when they're talking, they'll tell you a little bit more about what they do as well. We are going to talk about the exam process, but we're also going to be talking about an exciting new interpretive notice that is coming soon to a rule book near you. It is AP Supervision. And we're going to kind of give you an overview of it. And so something new than what we always talk about here. But to get us started, how many of you have been through an NFA exam process, either for your firm or helped your firm go through it? Wow, not as many as usual. So good. We're going to start quickly going through the exam process. And those of you who've been through it, you can keep us honest and tell us, you know, where we went wrong and what we've discussed and how your experience differed so that everyone can learn from it. We love this to be interactive. So I know it's stressful to wait for the microphone to come and, you know, there's big pauses, but we would love your questions as we're going through this. So don't hesitate to ask, okay? We're here for you today, so let's get your questions answered. Okay, so NFA's exam process is we have a risk-based approach. And risk-based means there's two ways that we're risk-based. First, it's in our exam selection process. And secondly, it's what we look at when we do our exam. It's called our scoping. And we have a risk-based scope selection as well. So how do we decide who of our 3,000 NFA members to visit next? Well, we have a risk management group who takes all of the data that we have on file at NFA regarding your firm and analyzes it, puts it against models. Some of the things it looks at is how long you've been registered without an exam, what the exam findings were the last time we examined you, if there's been any customer complaints against your firm, things related to your financial statement filings, disclosure document filings, and this model kind of tells us here's who we think you should go to next. But then we have a qualitative analysis by actual people who go through that data and kind of establish who we think would be better, you know, would be a higher risk this time than others. So we put out a quarterly schedule and our teams head out to do their exams. So that is kind of how we pick it. And the scope selection, like I mentioned, is also risk-based. That's why, like on the last panel, Jim went through all the things that would be really great in the questionnaire if it was accurate and true. That helps us focus our attention where we need to and not waste everybody's time, yours and ours, looking at things that are lower risk. So that is kind of how you're selected, but I'm going to turn it over to Steve, who has announced many exams, to tell us about the actual exam process.
Thanks, Patty. So my name is Steve Coleman. I'm a senior manager in the New York Compliance Office, and I specialize in FCM and FDM exams. So a lot of you appear to have been through exams before, so what I'm going to do over these next couple of slides is just to provide a high-level overview of the exam process. So if your firm is selected, the exam is typically announced virtually or remotely. More specifically, the team will give you a phone call to announce that an exam is taking place, discuss some key dates with you, and maybe even talk about potential on-site visits. So one aspect of this It just explains why or emphasizes why it's important that your contact information in ORS is accurate and up to date. And those numbers really should be direct phone numbers, not going to an answering service, so that's very helpful. So during the announcement call or directly after, the exam team will provide you with questionnaire documents, such as a firm profile questionnaire or a pre-exam questionnaire. We use these to collect information related to firm operations, key personnel, detail related to the firm's customer base, and investment products and or investment services offered. Other documents that you might get to fill out are the internal control and or general questionnaire. These documents help us gather details regarding firm internal controls over transactions, financial reporting, and operational procedures. So again, a point to make here is to kind of reiterate what Patty said is make sure that these are fully filled out in detail, especially those questions that revolve around internal controls. You might think of your response as almost a desktop procedure. We need to understand the key personnel, the key systems that are involved, and we really need a step-by-step process from beginning to end. So a document request letter or engagement letter will also be provided at this time. This letter will provide an initial list of documents needed for testing and directs the firm to upload responses to NFA's regulatory filing system by certain deadlines. And just one quick comment there about deadlines. I think the engagement letter is going to tell you everything on it is due in 10 days. Subsequent requests are usually required within 48 hours. But, you know, we understand that, you know, these exams might not always come at a convenient time. So just make sure you come and talk to us about deadlines. You know, if you let us know that something's going on or that you're having trouble meeting deadlines, we can help you establish new deadlines or even reprioritize what we're working on. But at the end of the day, like, we want to get what we need, you know, to keep the exam process moving forward. That's in everybody's best interest to be able to complete these things as quickly as we can. So I think that's the next slide. Is when we say exam approach, we're really talking about how we interact with you physically. So most NFA exams are a hybrid approach. So while initial meetings and discussions and even some subsequent meetings may be held virtually, we typically want to complete part of this exam on site at the firm. So when an exam team is on site, we look to conduct key personnel interviews, directly observe execution of procedures and controls, review firm records, and have meetings to discuss specific questions or requests related to those records, and directly discuss and share with the firm any exam findings as they're discovered. So as for exam findings noted during the exam, just one thing I want to point out. The firm should be looking to provide corrective action as soon as possible for two reasons. One, NFA wants firms with identified issues to make corrective action right away rather than continue to operate with regulatory deficiencies. And second, if deficiencies are not corrected when the exam report is being crafted, it really doesn't allow us any flexibility when considering what deficiencies are included in an exam report or not. So if corrective action has been implemented and we're satisfied with it, it gives us a lot more flexibility when we start having questions with or conversations with senior management about what's going to be in a report or not. And just one other comment about the virtual meetings. We typically use Microsoft Teams. We can use other means of communications, but that's what we primarily use. So I think that's it for that slide. So now, end of exam process. So near the end of the exam process, which CPO, CTA, IB exams, is probably more like 115 days, somewhere in that time frame. FCM, FDM exams are probably more like 145. NFA is going to be looking to schedule an exit meeting. So at that exit, we're going to go over a summary of the scope of the exam, you know, talk to you about everything we tested. We're going to go over our exam findings again, even though these are going to be communicated with you throughout the process. And we're going to discuss the status of any corrective action, whether a matter is closed or it's still open, and we're looking for you to provide us with something. So at that point, at that exit meeting, we're going to issue a report, or shortly after, we'll issue a report. So if findings are included in the report and a response is required, that response is usually required within 10 business days. But again, like I said, with deadlines, I mean, there's flexibility. If you need more than 10 days to respond, you just need to reach out to the exam team and talk to them. Also, if there's findings in your report, please make sure that your response includes detail related to the circumstances that led to each finding, any corrective action that's been implemented, or the status of firm efforts to implement corrective action, and any changes to firm procedures and internal controls in response to NFA's exam. Like, we need a good detailed response. Otherwise, there will be follow-up and more clarification. So that's kind of a high-level overview of the exam process. Does anybody have any questions about that?
I did see, while we're getting a microphone to you, I did see some panicked faces when Steve said, 120, 145 days. I want to assure you that we are not in your face for that entire process. There's a flurry of activity and questions and document requests in the beginning. Then the staff steps away and is looking through the records, documenting their testing. You might get some more questions as things are getting finished by the staff and the supervisors reviewing. So it ebbs and flows. It's not 145 days just constantly dealing with NFA. Okay.
Hi. Quick question. What is the maximum amount of time an exam should take? Because even though the exit interview can happen, that doesn't mean the end of the exam. So what's a reasonable total length of time until an exam is wrapped up?
So it very much depends on lots of things, but the pre-exam process that Steve mentioned is happening before the start of field work. So these are the initial operations call, getting you the document request list, things like that. So that's going to happen, sometimes 2 to 6 weeks prior to us even starting the exam. Once the exam starts, the CFTC requires us to issue a report within 150 days. So that is kind of the next ending point. But then, as Steve mentioned, we're going to want a response to any deficiencies. And if that's not complete, we could be going back and forth a little bit on that. But like I just mentioned, we shouldn't be in your face that entire time.
No, indeed. But is 2 years too long? Is a year and a half too long?
Yeah, I mean, it's after that report is given to you, hopefully it's very quick after that.
And if it's not, who do we come and speak to?
The director on the exam.
And if we don't want to speak to the director on the exam, is there anybody else we can speak to?
You can contact me if I'm not the director on the exam, or we have managing directors who can address things with you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And as an exam team, like, we don't have a problem with that. If you want to escalate matters and talk to senior management people, we can accommodate that. So,
and that wouldn't cloud any aspect of the exam if we did that.
Not at all.
Thank you.
There's one over here, Matthew. Maybe more mics.
Thank you. Hi there, me again. As far as the exams are concerned, my situation is unique in that the firm that I work for is absorbing all kinds of little firms all over the place. Not all of them have any NFA-related activity, but some do. And if you were to show up at a place like my little hypothetical scenario I just posed, are you treating that as you guys are growing and learning as you go, or are you coming in guns blazing? I love the NFA. Let me just say that out loud. And I come from a broker-dealer background, so I've dealt with the SEC and, FINRA, former regulator, as I noted before, you guys are a pleasure to work with. I just don't know they've never had an NFA exam, so they keep asking me, and I say, well, I've never worked at a firm like this one. So, how do we approach that? Because I've been through multiple NFA exams, so I know how to handle it, but from that, this location may be doing this, but this other office is doing that. How do you guys handle that with so many legacy offices and things of that nature?
So, I don't own a gun, so there won't be any guns blazing. But, these guys can give you more perspective as well. But as you're accumulating all these things and legacy systems. I mean, you have to keep your policies and procedures up to date and changing to incorporate the new operations and be sure that you have supervisors who understand the legacy systems and can use them. So I think that's where we tend to see more issues at these types of firms, is just not being able to keep the supervisory structure that you used to have on this small firm up to date with all these new acquisitions. But I think every exam, absent fraud, is a learning experience and a growth experience. But then, yes, when something terribly bad is happening, then NFA has to get very serious about that as well.
And I can tell you a little bit about my perspective on that. The exam team is there to provide regulatory oversight, but I also think part of that mission is, you know, to help you meet your regulatory requirements where we can. So we're going to work with you in that aspect too. So keep that in mind. So.
I'm sure of them. I just hope they're listening. The other thing is that you could use... I'm sorry. The other thing is that we do have a lot of resources on our website. The self-examination questionnaire really helps you go through a lot of the important areas and making sure if you're doing that diligently, you should be hitting a lot of your areas.
Hold on.
Thank you. As a point of clarification, I got a Barry White voice. As a point of clarification, did you say, or did I hear you say that if there was a finding during examination and it was remediated, it will not be included in the report?
It gives us flexibility to not include it. If you have findings in an exam and there is no remediation, it's pretty much cut and dry. It's going to go in a report. But if the corrective action has been provided, then there's going to be a discussion about materiality, the overall scope of the exam, the overall nature of the findings. So there can be more of a discussion about, you know, what's going to end up in a report or not. Keep in mind, senior management makes the final decision on that. So
appreciate that. Thank you.
Hi. Is there any update on the potential upgrade of RFS to be more user-friendly and to accommodate, large size files with file names greater than a certain number of characters? Just there's technological limitations with the multitude of NFA systems that elongate and complicate the initial document upload process and the overall exam experience.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. RFS works for about 90% of the members, and 10% of the members have a lot of real issues because file names are too long, sizes are too big. So it is one of the many IT projects that we have in the horizon, but I don't have a current update as to when that will happen. But I appreciate you raising the concern, and we will definitely take it back.
Hi, Maxine Klein, UBS. I'm just curious, how do you observe internal controls working on site? As in, what are you physically doing? And how do you know the people you're watching aren't just kind of showing you the best version of their control?
I can tell you, like, my preference would be to stand behind the person actually doing their job and watch them do it with live transactions. So, I mean, we focus on receipts and disbursements of customer funds, disbursements, not for the benefit of customers, investment of customer funds. I mean, those things, if there are live current transactions, we're going to ask you to provide us access to those people. Maybe that's going to be going to their desk and watching them. Maybe that's going to be bringing them into a conference room, have them sign in, watch them do the transaction. So we're going to make every attempt to see a live transaction with the people that actually do that. There is some flexibility there because we understand, like, if we're talking about investment of customer funds, maybe you're not doing that every day. There is some flexibility, but our preference is to see the real people doing the task on a day-to-day basis actually doing the task. So
that's the official walkthrough. And if there, is not, like at pool operators, a lot of that is not happening every single day. There's inspection of documents. We'll select the transactions and you'll have to provide us with, here's the checklist that I went through and here's what I did as well.
Hi, my name is Sarah Castro, and I'm at work at Enlace, which is a very niche interest rate based swaps. And I just joined the firm, and just when I joined, we have an NFA examination process, and I've seen my boss grow gray hairs faster by the day. My question more relates to the on-site visit. I have no clue what to expect. I just graduated, jumped right in. So this is very new to me, and I just want to know what to expect because I don't know. I don't know what's going on.
So I think we talked about it a little bit.
Well, just the on-site visit. I mean, we're going to come in and want to confirm some things with people who are doing it. So like we said, the internal control walkthroughs is part of that. We might be interviewing people more senior who weren't on the operations call, or maybe even more junior, people who are actually doing things. So it's a lot of interviewing and, again, asking for specific documents. So the internal the initial document request was broader, and so now we might select, you know, specific customer accounts to look at, or orders, or depending, you know, whatever the operations is.
And I think one thing to keep in mind, too, is it's really beneficial for our staff to be out in the field meeting market professionals like yourself, and it goes a long way towards helping us develop good qualified staff examiners, which we all want. So,
thank you.
All right. In the interest of time, we're going to move to the next section. So, Dawn, introduce yourself and tell us about common exam findings.
Okay. So my name is Dawn Grossmith. I am an associate director here in the New York office. I oversee our financial analysis and surveillance team, which some of you are probably familiar with, because when you submit statements, financial statements, we do reviews of those. Also, if you've ever called into phone duty, chances are you could have been talking to some staff on my team. I also oversee an exam team as well. Okay, so moving on to common exam findings. When we conduct examinations, as you can imagine, certain issues just tend to come up repeatedly amongst firms. So if you understand these common findings, we think that it will help to strengthen your compliance programs and hopefully help you avoid those potential exam findings in the future. So one thing that we do is you can expect that we're going to review several key procedures to ensure that you have compliance. Some of these areas are like cybersecurity, your promotional materials, internal controls, as we mentioned, trade communications, and order placement. Common procedure findings typically fall into three buckets. One is not maintaining a written procedure at all, whether formal or informal. Two is not creating an adequate written procedure. Or three, having an informal procedure that's just not documented. So the most common of the issues I mentioned is not creating an adequate written procedure. And the best way for you to really avoid this is to make sure that you're reviewing all the interpretive notices, the rules, and regulations that will help you develop these procedures and make a strong framework. You also want to make sure that these procedures are addressing the risks of your firm. So what's an acceptable set of supervisory procedures has really been a hot topic, and we're going to go into this a little bit more on the next slide. But another common scenario we come across is firms having an informal procedure and review, and then they don't document anything. Documentation really is key, because if you keep your documentation, then that's evidence that you are doing your supervisory of these procedures. My recommendation is simple. Like, always formalize your procedures in writing. Ensure they're reasonable, detailed, and they most importantly, that they make sense for your firm.
Okay. So with that, let's talk about AP supervision and this new interpretive notice that's coming out. Whether your firm trades futures, options on futures, retail forex, digital assets, swaps, NFA has a rule that is very general that says you have to supervise your employees in all aspects of its commodity interest business. That's pretty much what it says, very broad, right? And so over the years, members have asked us for guidance. Sometimes it comes with, why don't you just tell me what you want me to do? But for the most part, it is, you know, can we have more specific guidance on this? And as Dawn pointed out, we've been looking at all of these areas on the last slide for decades and asking you how you're supervising this area. And then we often will find deficiencies in those areas and can almost always point to a breakdown in supervision that led to the violation. So we've had violations in these areas. We've had members asking us for more guidance. So we did put together an interpretive notice on AP supervision. This passed our board at the end of February. And so now, as Mike mentioned earlier, everything has to go to the CFTC for review. So we are in the process of getting that interpretive notice sent to the CFTC for their approval. I don't think once you see this that you're going to find much different than what we've already been examining you for. This slide kind of goes through the minimum requirements that we are requiring. I think you'll see, you know, written supervisory procedures is all throughout it, and the fact that you need to assess that on at least an annual basis as to whether or not your supervisory program has kept up with your operations and is doing what you expect it to do. So you're going to see that throughout this part. I don't have an effective date yet for you, but there's two things I want you to know. One, it's like all of NFA's interpretive notices. It includes a degree of flexibility because all of your operations are different, so we want you to be able to tailor this program to your operations. And the second thing is we do not make things effective as soon as they're published. We will pick a point in the future that makes sense so that you can take the time to read through it, understand it, and compare it to your current supervisory program and identify any gaps that you need to fill. But again, I don't think you're going to find that many gaps. It just is making it well known to everyone what we're looking at. So we are going to jump into the interp in a little bit more detail, I think. Okay, like I mentioned, written supervisory procedures. Dawn has already told you this. You want to make sure things are reasonably designed to ensure your AP's activities comply with all applicable NFA and CFTC regulations. So you want to identify potential areas where you need to focus your attention, define the frequency and scope of the supervisory tasks that you're going to perform, define what records you're going to maintain to demonstrate that you have supervised, and you want to make sure that the procedures talk about how you're going to escalate or resolve any issues that are fine. So we'll go into the specific areas, but that's what overall the written supervisory procedures should do. You want to be sure that you're also identifying either by title or department the area that is going to be supervising things. So that's important to identify as well. So Steve, why don't you jump into some of the specific areas covered by the interp? Qualifications and hiring.
So qualifications and hiring. So one of the easiest ways to ensure that you're meeting your regulatory requirements is by hiring good qualified people. A good supervisory structure starts at the top. Having a qualified AP supervisor is crucial for ensuring employees are following policies and regulatory standards. Firms should seek to define areas of supervision and identify by title or position the person or persons responsible for performing each supervisory function. So obviously, hiring the right people is important and helps reduce the risk of noncompliance. So when in the hiring process, your due diligence should include background checks, prior employment history, and checking for any pending or prior disciplinary matters. So keep in mind, NFA's basic system is very useful for this. Basic will let you determine if the individual has or has not been involved in any prior disciplinary actions by the NFA, CFTC, or any exchanges. Lastly, make sure you and your procedures are addressing ongoing due diligence. Firms should require APs to notify their employers of any new or pending disciplinary matters. And this can also be completed by requiring regular AP attestations on these topics, and you can always have your APs attesting that they have read and understand the firm's procedures annually.
Okay. Pre-trade communications.
Yeah, if we don't have any more comments about APs, we can move on to pre-trade communications. So for the next few slides, we're focusing on pre-trade communications and trading activity, which will be covered in more detail within the record keeping and e-communications presentation later today. So we're going to go through this pretty quickly. These matters largely relate to our IB and FCM members. That being said, I'm going to highlight a few key areas here on this slide. So for pre-trade communications, I want to focus on implementing systems and processes to ensure the equipment is functioning properly or that APs are only using approved communication channels. So that first item, outages and recording systems do occur. I've seen them. And can be material if not caught and remediated in a timely manner. It really shouldn't be NFA coming in and pointing out through testing that your system is not recording like it's supposed to. So this is something you really want to have a solid program around, developing a procedure and processes to test your systems that you have implemented to record and make these files available for retrieval later. And then a common issue we've also seen is gaps in communication by APs using unrecorded devices due to customers initiating conversations on an unapproved channel. So for this, ensuring APs are properly trained on how to handle these situations is really probably the best and first step in avoiding them. So
that's great. And now, Don, can you talk more about order handling and trading activities, please?
Sure. In addition to pre-trade communications, firms should also develop procedures on reviewing how orders are handled and what type of trading activity is actually occurring. Once again, we're looking for a written procedure to outline what the firm is doing, how often it's occurring, and what documentation is going to be maintained, and a process for escalating this. Firms frequently create generic and non-specific procedures indicating trading activity will be reviewed, and the support for this could simply be a sign-off on a customer monthly carrying broker statement. That on its own is not sufficient. So on the next slide, we're going to provide some more tips on what you could be doing to sufficiently supervise this area. Some supervisory measures you can consider when conducting trade and order placement review includes reviewing your error accounts and suspense accounts. Consider, are these accounts being used for what they're intended for? Also, do you have one AP that's generating more errors than others? Another thing is to monitor post-trade activity, such as position transfers. Position transfers present a higher degree of risk. And the main concern with this really is that an AP is transferring a winning position to another customer's account or perhaps even their own account. So maintaining procedures and documentation on any position transfers along with the reasoning is really a good key to supervising this type of activity. You also want to make sure that you're reviewing AP discretionary trading. If you have an AP that maintains discretion over accounts, the trading in these accounts needs to be reviewed regularly. And you should be reviewing your commission to equity ratios in these accounts. You want to review for total fees charged versus gains and losses on these accounts. This could help you detect any trading malpractices, such as churning. And reviewing all the trades, depending on, obviously, the size of your operations, just may not be feasible. So there's certain things that you may want to consider, such as accounts that have significant losses. They have high volumes of trades in them, or maybe they're charged a particularly high amount of commissions. So these would help these, considering some of these areas, will help you develop a scope of which accounts you want to be reviewing.
And the last area in the interpretive notice that's covered is training. So
as far as training goes, you would need to make sure that your APs are aware of not only the NFA rules and the CFTC regulations, but they also need to be aware of your own policies and procedures. Again, like everything else we're saying, documentation is really key to this. You want to make sure that the training approach and frequency is documented, as well as that the documentation should include how frequently this training is going to occur. And then when training is conducted, you want to make sure that you keep documentation on the content that was covered, as well as the dates the APs took this training.
And that is the end of the new interpretive notice. Was anything new and earth-shattering? Questions all the way over here, Matthew, in the back.
Thank you. Just on training, apart from the required AP training, does the staff take a view as far as broadening that scope for other folks who are involved in the investment process or principals of the organization who might be more involved in day-to-day decision-making?
We think training should be appropriate for your operation, right? So if it's not just APs that need to attend it, then it should be all those other people. And, for example, cybersecurity, everybody who has an email address probably needs to be taking cybersecurity training. So, yes.
Probably ethics, too, right?
Yeah, I was more focused on the ethics training. Apologies. Yeah, I was...
Ethics, you know, the rule itself says specifically associated persons. However, if it's appropriate for your operations to expand that to others, you should. Great question. Oh, now we're going to give Matthew his exercise today. Oh, okay, great. Hi.
Hi. It's my understanding that if you supervise an AP, you yourself must register as an AP. Does this new supervisory function require that anyone that performs the supervision to register as an AP, or can it be a function of legal or compliance?
It can be a function of legal and compliance. It really depends on, you know, compliance is usually more of a support role in this, right? Helping the systems, monitoring that people are doing what they're supposed to be doing. The AP requirement is more of a frontline supervisor and then the chain of command.
Great,
of
thank
person.
You.
Thank you. Will this interpretive notice be applicable to all the members, all member types, or select?
It's for all member types, including swap dealers and everybody else on the future side. So, yes. And as soon as it gets sent to the CFTC, it'll be on our website under rule submissions. So hopefully soon, so that you can all read it.
Hi, I'm Reggie from BlackRock. So typically for our employees, before you come in the door, we do a background check on everyone, whether you're in a business side or not. And so an employee who comes to the firm, sometimes it'll be maybe a year or 2 years before they get their Series 3 license and they get registered with the NFA, depending on if they, you know, had a role change or whatnot. Is the expectation that upon registration with the NFA that our firm does another background check in, you know, considering the 2 years has elapsed since their last background check before, during that process, is that the expectation? Or, because normally what we do now is we kind of forward those physical fingerprints to the NFA and you guys kind of coordinate with the FBI and do your own background check. Should firms be doing an additional background check that may seem redundant in addition to what you're doing already?
Yeah, we don't have any specific requirements on that. It's basically what you think is appropriate for you. So, you know, we say ongoing due diligence of these people. Some of it could just be that you've required them to keep you informed of things and then set up a schedule that's appropriate for you to go and do another background check.
Because I'm trying to think of it from an exam perspective. You guys come in and examine this. It's like, okay, well, this individual didn't have a background check in the past 4 years, you know, is the expectation that we're doing that, should be doing that on a regular basis?
It's what you've set up in your policy. Now, if you said you were going to do it every 2 years and you haven't done it, then that's going to be something we bring to your attention. But if your procedure is more, you know, risk-based or has more other factors to consider about when you redo it, then that's what we're going to look for compliance with.
Hi. Question, as far as APs are concerned, we have a CPO fund, so obviously we have principals in place as well. I've already disclosed that this is a newer experience for a lot of the people at my firm. I am leaning towards ethics training and the full boat for our principals as well, because they've never experienced it. My APs are all, you know, educated on a regular basis. Would the guidance be, even if it's light guidance, I would appreciate it, that I move in that direction for principals? Are you trying to enforce that in any way, or are you guys just principals are principals, APs are APs?
Yeah, principals are principals, okay. APs are APs, okay. And it's what makes sense for your operations.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
In the interest of time, we're going to keep moving. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you got to have at least one.
One AP print. So, Steve, we're going to talk quickly about some other common deficiencies and how to avoid them. Third-party service providers, fairly new interpretive notice, Steve, and what have we been seeing there?
So it is new, and we have seen a lot of issues lately in the use of third-party service providers. So this is when a firm has delegated its regulatory requirement or responsibility to a third party. So NFA Interpretive Notice 9079 requires member firms to have written supervisory procedures over the use of third parties. So it needs to be in writing, and it should contain details regarding an initial risk assessment and onboarding due diligence, as long as the relationship was established after September of 2021. Ongoing monitoring, termination, and details regarding adequate documentation to be maintained to prove the firm performed any phase of its procedures. So some other common issues we've seen here, besides inadequate written procedures, are firms failing to maintain that adequate evidence of procedures being formed, most notably the ongoing monitoring. And then one other issue I've seen in some of my examinations is firms not incorporating their affiliates into this process. So if you're leasing a system, an accounting system, a back office system from an affiliate, if your treasury team belongs to an affiliate and is staffed to you through an expense sharing agreement or some kind of intercompany agreement, like, you need to incorporate these affiliates into this process.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Steve. Don. Oh no, Steve, you're still. I'm out of whack.
We'll talk a little bit more about APs. So during exams, teams work to establish a full understanding of the firm's operations through these questionnaires, through their on-site visit, through conversations. So, but we want to make sure we have a full understanding of the firm's operations also as it relates to office personnel and firm activity conducted outside the main office, which has led to common exam issues regarding registration of APs and branch offices. So in these reviews, we look to ensure that individuals that engage in AP activity are properly registered. This includes individuals that supervise other APs and the overall hierarchy of AP supervision. Additionally, we review any locations outside the main office that have personnel engaged in AP activity to ensure these locations are properly registered as branch offices, although there is an exception to that requirement. Specifically, you don't have to list a location as a branch office so long as there's only one AP working there. The location is not held out to the public as an office of the member. The AP does not meet in person with customers or physically handle customer funds at that location. And any required regulatory records created at that location are accessible for inspection at the member's office. So one thing to keep in mind here, for these types of non-branch offices, firms should still be supervising the activities of the APs in the location. So,
great. Thank you, Steve. Let's switch to CPO-CTA issues. Dawn.
So the CPO and CTA financial ratios are common deficiencies. These are the ratios that you're submitting on your quarterly PQRs and PRs. The ratios, first of all, they need to be on the member firm's numbers. Sometimes we see firms do this on, like, their pools numbers instead.
for the current assets and current liabilities ratio, just make sure you're using the current assets and current liabilities. Sometimes we see the firms use total assets over total liabilities. Also, if you have zero current liabilities, keep in mind that your ratio should be zero. For the total revenue, total expense ratio, this should be a rolling 12 months of revenue and expenses. Again, frequently we see firms do the quarter or year-to-date numbers instead. It should always be accrual basis of accounting, and just make sure you're keeping your support, because when we come do an exam, we're going to ask you for that support. And the next one is the 250 notice filing. This is not our most common notice filing, but it does have the most common deficiencies. If you are a CPO, just be aware that if your pools cannot meet its margin calls, they are unable to satisfy their redemptions in accordance with the subscription agreements, the pools halted redemptions, or the CPO receives notice from a swap counterparty that a pool it operates is in default, you have to file this 250 notice by 5 p.m. the following day. Also, although we highlighted the 250 notice, in general, timeliness is the most common deficiency notice with
everything.
And specifically with notice filing. So just keep this in mind if you have a change in CPA or a change in your fiscal year end.
All right, thank you. And I'm going to kind of bring us home because we are out of time. The last area is exemptions for CPOs who and CTAs who are operating under a 4.7 exemption. This is for qualified eligible persons. A reminder that the CFTC did update the portfolio requirement for a QEP. This does not require you to go to all of your current participants and clients and be sure they meet the new portfolio requirement. However, any new participant or client or any client or participant who wants to add additional funds, you do need to do that reassessment. So you'll want to be sure that you have that new portfolio requirement that is going into effect on March 26th. So I'm going to stop there and ask if anybody else has questions, because we're out of time. And of course, Matthew just left you all the way over where you were standing, Matthew. Okay, shout and I will speak it.
If there's a location that meets all of these requirements but has two APs there instead of just one, does that mean it needs to be registered as a branch, or is it just sort of?
Yes.
It has to. So anything
unless
that's
they're
an exemption,
related,
only have one AP.
Unless they are from the same household. So if they're, you know, father, son, husband, wife,
okay.
Then if there's two APs, that makes it have to be a listed branch.
Got it. But if they're not related, then it needs to be.
Yes.
If Joe goes to John's house to be an AP together, they need to be registered. Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Just quickly on the third-party risk assessment, the September 2021 date, I think, I don't know if I heard this right, you said that the assessment wasn't required for relationships that started before September 2021? Or did I misunderstand that?
The onboarding and initial risk assessment is only required for firm for relationships that you entered after September 2021.
But the annual update is then required for all. Okay.
Your ongoing monitoring. If you if you renegotiate contract terms, this is kicking things in again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi. Just to follow up on the branch office, if you have an office, a separate office, you only have one AP there, they don't handle customer funds, they don't meet with clients, it doesn't need to be a branch?
If you don't advertise it as a branch, you know, like that location's not on your website as a potential branch, correct.
But if it is on your website as another office location?
Then that's holding it out to the public as a location.
Okay.
Would need to be listed.
Do you have your firm name on a billboard outside?
It's a different entity name than the CPO. It's a It's an affiliate.
Well, now we're getting into it. It also would have to be held out as your entity. You know, people need to know who they're doing business with, so be careful there too.
It's a very specific entity for research.
Why don't we talk, you and I talk afterwards, okay? Idea. That sounds pretty firm specific there.
I see somebody.
Okay, we're getting short on time. We're actually over time, Matthew, so do you want to keep moving or one more? Okay, and we'll
get to you.
Thanks. So I think a quick one, when we talk about registration and we have branch offices, if you look at 9019, there's a section around the annual inspection requirement and it only speaks to branch offices. What are your expectations with regard to the main office? It seems kind of silent on whether that's also an annual inspection requirement.
Main office has got to have every possible supervisory procedure in place that you could possibly imagine, so you don't necessarily have to have a third party come and make sure you're following all that. You just have to be following all that. All right. Not that exams have to be done by a third party. I shouldn't have said that, but yes. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for all of your participation and questions. We are still around, so I know there were many of you we didn't get to. Please grab us, and we'll answer more. And thank you so much, Dawn and Steve, for all of your participation.